The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Pretty interesting that they asked the FBI to go through one of his summer homes, at which time they walked out with at least six documents that were between 25 and 30, as well as notes and things about his daily planner and schedule. What do you think about this procedure?
Look, as my days as a former prosecutor and leading the intelligence community, I've never heard of this type of procedure, especially when it comes to the leaks of classified documents that are being in the wild. And what I think people aren't focusing on is the so-called the way they're laying this out, the verbiage. The six sets, to me, a classified document, one set, is something that's going to be more than one page. I've seen classified documents that are up to 1,000 pages per set. So they're not telling the American public the amount of pages and actual substance that was found at just this one location.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, a lot of mystery, huh? Still surrounding the papers that are coming to light at President Joe Biden's places. Good afternoon. It's good to be with you today. I'm Drew Mariani. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for hanging out. We got a lot to get into today. Always a mixed bag. Always something fun to listen to and to talk about. And you're welcome to join me anytime. 888-914-9149 if you want to get into the conversation. I'm not sure if President Biden has learned any lessons from his condemnation of the former president over the classified documents Trump had at Mar-a-Lago. But one of those lessons might be, hey, don't throw stones if you live in a glass house, right? They came off very high and mighty in an interview he did. And, oh, take classified documents very seriously. And what are we seeing? I mean, this is such a mess. And you're probably fatigued from hearing about it. It's been a drip, drip, drip of new information that continues to come out. I personally have a lot of questions. Yeah, I really do. If something's marked top secret, are we over classifying certain documents? And if they are indeed our nation's most sensitive secrets, then why aren't our elected officials respecting them and holding them in greater accord? Right? They're in boxes in people's garages and spread all over the place. The FBI spent 13 hours this weekend searching the president's house in Wilmington, Delaware. None of it, it wasn't done this with the same kind of fanfare as Trump. And this is what some people have a problem with. I'm just looking at it very objectively here. You know, if you take a look at what happened in Mar-a-Lago versus what happened in Wilmington, Trump had people, come through wearing FBI jackets, carrying their guns, right? There was no heavy armament, no dogs, none of that stuff at President Biden's place in Wilmington. Just some friendly neighborhood FBI agents showing up. And believe it or not, after the president's attorney said, that, oh, we've given you everything, they find another six items that didn't belong in that house. Oh, surprise, surprise. And let me just stop on that point. I don't want to go too deep into this issue today, but I'm just ruminating about it. I'm thinking, okay, my personal attorney is going to my house, and the FBI, the Justice Department, is going to believe anything they tell him? My attorney might say, hey, Drew, look, man, I know you probably didn't mean this, but we found six other classified documents here. You know, plus, in light of all that went down with Trump, don't you think you clean your own house? Say, oh, I better make sure I got none of that in my own closet, right? Or my own garage, or wherever the stuff is now. So that was not the case. It was just not the case. And there is, people are comparing the two cases in terms of intent, in terms of who had the authority to declassify, in terms of the way the way law enforcement is handling it. So it's something to watch. We'll see how it all shakes out, what exactly the items are that were found at the president's house now. Notice they didn't say documents. They said items. They said items. Words to me, I'm very tuned into words. What does that mean? It wasn't made clear. It did come out that at least one, quote, item came from Biden's time in the Senate. Really? That long ago? Which means he had something he should have had for years. Years. Even NPR. And NPR can tack pretty liberal. They're starting to say the White House has been, selective, let's say, in their disclosures about these documents. And it is telling, because I'm seeing a lot of the left media, a lot of liberal media, a lot of people who would normally sweep this under the rug or make excuses for it, realizing that they've been stonewalled and lied to, right? And they're starting to ask some real questions now. But we'll see what happens. I think timing is so critical in all this. Was this leaked because somebody doesn't want the president to run? It's kind of my theory on it. It really is. Why else would this now come to light? Why else would it come to light? He did great in the midterms, and he was puffed up over that and said, you know what? I'm going to run. He hasn't made the announcement yet. He'll make that after the State of the Union. But that being said, who knows? We'll see if anything even comes from him. People have very short memories. Maybe it won't matter at all when it comes to the general elections. One other thing I've been following, and you and I have been talking about, the search for the person responsible for the leaking of the first draft of the Dobbs decision. I'm still perplexed over why none of that has come to light. The Supreme Court marshals, a person named Gail Curley, was given the task to investigate the leak and released a statement on Friday saying that the justices, the Supremes, right, they were interviewed as part of that investigation, and none of them are implicated in the leak. Also confirmed that none of the justices or their spouses were responsible for leaking the opinion. So, yeah, let's say Clarence Thomas comes home or Kagan or whoever it might be, right? And this major case is coming. I mean, would you confide that in your spouse? I know I'm not supposed to talk to you about this, but oh my gosh, you know, here's what's going to happen. I mean, is that the possibility? Well, according to the investigator, no. The justices are in the clear, and so are the spouses. However, I think they interviewed like 89 people. It's very possible that those people who had access to that could have told somebody else. I mean, how do you keep a secret with 89 people, especially a secret as significant as the Dobbs decision and what it meant for Roe? So I think it's fascinating. I have part of an interview that Justice Alito did with the Heritage Foundation regarding that SCOTUS leak. Listen to this.
So one of the most remarkable features about the court in an age of incessant leaks is the confidentiality that long covered its internal deliberations. Unfortunately, that changed this last term with the horrific and completely unprecedented leak of your draft majority opinion in Dobbs. How has the leak affected the court?
It was a grave betrayal of trust by somebody, and it was a shock because nothing like that had happened in the past. So it certainly changed the atmosphere at the court for the remainder of last term. The leak also made those of us who were thought to be in the majority in support of overruling Roe and Casey targets for assassination, because it gave people a rational reason to think they could prevent that from happening by killing one of us. And we know that a man has been charged with attempting to kill Justice Kavanaugh. It's a pending case, so I won't say anything more about that. But that was last term. Now we're in a new term. I think that all of us want to, all of the justices, and I think the people who work in the building, we have a wonderful staff, I'll add that, want things to get back to normal.
Yeah, no kidding. And let's hope that's the case, but how do things get back to normal, right, in the future, when you have other very big Supreme Court decisions? How does it get back to normal if you're not sure who your leaker is? I mean, who do you share information with, right? There is no normal, right? It won't be normal again until the person who violated their oath is brought to justice, right? This is one of the most revered institutions we have in our country. I'm just struck by it. I mean, the older I get, the more I'm beginning to reevaluate my thought process sometimes. I'm thinking, I really thought I could see things pretty clearly. And I'm like, I just don't get why this is not of greater importance. There was an assassination attempt on one of the sitting Supreme Court justices. Somebody leaked this information, which indirectly set this guy off. And nobody's going to be brought to justice for this? It's food for thought. I'll continue to follow it. In fact, over the past few weeks, I've been tracking that case. There'll be more developments, I'm sure, in the not-too-distant future. But I do want to just clear up that the investigation has said that the Supremes and their spouses were not the leakers. Because some people might have said, well, what if one of the justices said to one of their aides, this is bad, you know, we got to do something about it. And it went that way. That's all speculation. It's been set clear. I don't want to create any scandal. the Supreme Court justices and their spouses in the clear. Who did it? That's the big question. Hey, internationally, I want to just continue to call you to pray for peace in the world. I am concerned. I had a long time ago worked on a project where I looked at this phenomenon of apparitions. And in many of these apparitions, the Mother of God gave prophecies about events that would come. And many of them have come true. You know, you take a look at La Salette, what happened there about the great blight and the famine. You take a look at Fatima and the rise of the Second World War. You take a look at Champion, Wisconsin, where the Virgin talked of a chastisement in 12 years to the date. One of the worst recorded fires in U.S. history took place, right? And today, you know, we do have a lot of reported visions of the Mother of God and warning us, saying this is a time of grace for us, a time of prayer. And God's calling you to pray and to be in relationship with Him, to change your life, to do penance, to pray for peace. We take it for granted. We take it for granted. You know, there's been some very ugly chapters in world history. Over the weekend, Polish officials said that they were in consultation with Germany about giving Ukraine some of those German-built tanks. Poland said that, look, if Germany doesn't consent to giving those tanks, we're going to do it anyway. And that, along with discussions in NATO about giving tanks to Ukraine, brought, another dire warning from Russia. The leader of the Duma, Russia's lower house of parliament, said this. And just I shared with you what Medvedev had said the other day, what Vladimir Putin has threatened, right, in the past. All this you could interpret as saber rattling, perhaps, threats. Here's what the leader of the Duma said. He says, if Washington and NATO countries supply weapons that will be used to strike civilian cities in attempt to seize our territories as they threaten, this will lead to retaliatory measures using more powerful weapons. What are the more powerful weapons? And what does that mean in terms of retaliation? He was very clear that he was talking about nuclear weapons is what he was saying. Maybe tactical nukes. We don't know. We'll see. Nobody wants to see this. Nobody wants to see a third world war, right? One of the headlines that I had come across when I saw that, which was gave me a little pause. What he warned, and I'll share one more sentence. Let me see if I can find this here. Here's what he said. He says he warned the U.S. and NATO that this could lead to a, quote, terrible war. Terrible war. So that means it's not just going to be Ukraine, right? And that they would use retaliatory measures using more powerful weapons. Now, arguments that nuclear powers have not previously used weapons of mass destruction in local conflicts are unattainable, he said. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. One final story, and then David Dearson is going to be stopping by. I want to get his take on another story. But we've had another tragic mass shooting in our country. Did you hear about this? It has to be mental illness if you saw this. And again, pray for the families. It's just so sad. Los Angeles, while the Chinese community was celebrating their Lunar New Year, there was a 72-year-old man who came into an open-air festival in Monterey and started shooting. And I just think of profilers. I mean, this certainly is not the demo, right? It's not the demographic for a mass shooter. But the 72-year-old man killed 10 people, injured another 10. And he then went to a police, a place of business and threatened there. But, he was confronted by the owner and the man fled. He was later found dead with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. So just tragedy and loss all the way around. The Archbishop Jose Gomez, he issued a statement in response to this. And here's what he said. He said, quote, "We ask our Blessed Mother Mary to intercede for us, to be a mother to us in this hour of pain and uncertainty. May she help us to care for those who are suffering and to be healers and peacemakers in our world." So thank you, Your Excellency, for those words. And we can join him in that as well. As you hear these stories, I always say a chapel whenever I hear about tragedy or an accident or something like that. You never know what soul needs him. And then finally, Buzz Aldrin, second man to ever walk on the moon. I had the great privilege of interviewing him. I'd love to talk to the guy who sailed with Columbus. It'd be kind of cool. Neil Armstrong walking on the moon. Buzz Aldrin, second boots down. I think he's 90 years old or 93 years old. He's up there right now, right? Over the weekend, he got married. He got married for the fourth time in his life, this time to Dr. Anka Faur. She's a chemical engineer who's the executive vice president of his company. And It happened. He's 93. Yeah, 93 years of age. He says we're as excited as eloping teenagers at 93. All right, way to go, Buzz. I'm super impressed. That's awesome. Good for you. I hope he's happy. I mean, 93 years of age. That's a, and she, just for a little reference, he likes to marry young. Guess how old she is? No, Maggie went 54. That's half his age. Not a bad guess. 63. 30 years his younger. 30 years is younger. Hey, I want to change gears. I want to talk about something else. I want your take on this. David Deers is going to be joining me. Geraldine Tyler. She's 94, right? 94-year-old widow in Minneapolis. She lives in an assisted living facility. Not long ago, she owned a one-bedroom condo in the city. She was doing fine with it until about 2010 when crime in the neighborhood forced her to move out, and she started renting the apartment in a safer part of the city. Well, she couldn't keep up with the rent, and the taxes she owed on the condo began to mount, and she fell behind on them. And if you've ever been behind in your bills and behind in your taxes, you know how dreadful that can be, right? So her fees and fines added up to about $15,000, and Hennepin County seized the condo. They sold it a year later for $40,000. That to me just doesn't seem right. You're going to seize this lady's condo. You know, what's it worth? $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, over $15,000. Why not sell it and give her whatever remains? But instead of giving Geraldine the excess, let's just take the sale amount, $40,000, subtract $15,000, that's $25,000 back to her. The county kept it. And that's what law in Minnesota allows. So from 2014 to 2020, some 1,200 Minnesotans had similar situations where they completely lost their home equity when their home was seized back. Well, I love this lady, 94, like I said, she's not taking it sitting down. Sued the county and federal district court, claiming that the home equity is a private property and the county can't just go taking it. Court dismissed her case. She appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. They've agreed to hear it. That's why I've invited David Deersen, part of Pacific Legal Foundation, who is representing her, to give us some light on this amazing story. David, good afternoon.
Thanks very much. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I've always marveled about these types of stories. Let's say you own a home. It's worth $500,000, right? You fall behind in your taxes. Say you owe $25,000 or even $50,000. The state can come in, the government can come in and take your house, right? I mean, because you failed to pay your taxes. But if you own your home, and you had $500,000 worth of equity and you still couldn't meet that tax burden, you lose all of that. You lose that $450,000. That never seemed just or right to me. Can you explain how this works?
Well, sure thing. I'll start by agreeing with you completely. It's totally unjust and it's not right. And for what it's worth, in about 38 states in this country, that can't happen. It's only about a dozen states where the government is purportedly authorized to come in and take everything from you over a small tax debt. One of those states is Minnesota. And there they say, well, you know, you shouldn't have fallen behind. Now the home belongs to us. And that's on top, of course, of all the penalties, interests, and fees they lay on there. You know, her initial tax debt was only about $2,300. And that balloons to about $15,000 once they tack on the penalties. So you're already being penalized for this. And then they come in and say, well, you owe us everything you have. You know, in a lot of cases, people's home equity is the main source of their wealth. It's a major driver for generational wealth. It's completely unjust when the government profits off of people's small mistakes.
Yeah, it's sad. So what's her likelihood of winning this?
Oh, well, we're feeling pretty good about it over at Pacific Legal. You know, we recently, in 2019, won on a similar issue at the Supreme Court of Michigan. Now, the ruling in that case was limited to the Michigan Constitution, so the court didn't comment on the federal Constitution. But we've since had success in a case in the Federal Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. That was another case out of Michigan where they said, well, this practice violates not just the Michigan Constitution, but the United States Constitution as well. So we're hoping the Supreme Court will see that pretty clearly. And, you know, in addition to the claim that this is a taking of private property without just compensation, we're also arguing, you know, as sort of an alternative claim, that if it's not a taking of property without just compensation, then it's an excessive fine. You know, the Eighth Amendment is famous for prohibiting cruel and unusual punishments, but people forget that it also prohibits excessive fines. Now, the courts below ruled that this isn't really an excessive fine because it's not really meant to be punitive. It's just what they call a civil remedy. But of course, it's a little bit ironic and counterintuitive to think of a non-punitive penalty. So we think it is punitive. We think it is an excessive fine, in addition to being the taking of private property without just compensation. So between those two constitutional provisions, we're hoping this thing won't stand.
You know, if she does win, I'm curious as to what happens. Does that mean that these laws all over the country are going to be struck down?
Yeah, that's right. Laws all over the country are going to be effectively nullified. And I'd say it's in the best interest of state legislatures, if there are any lawmakers out there listening, it's in the best interest to fix these things now before it's too late. Because once the Supreme Court rules, if it rules that it's unconstitutional, it's going to be a lot of people with potential claims against their governments for massive profits. Like you mentioned at the top of the segment, we've done studies on this, and we found, you know, out of 12 Minnesota counties over the last 6 years, about $118 million in equity was stolen. And in a study of 19 cities in New Jersey, which is another state where this happened, homeowners lost over $140 million. So that's a lot of liability for the government, and I would encourage the bad states, the states that allow this theft of home equity, to change their laws before they incur additional liability.
Well, I wish you the very best. I'm so grateful you are defending her in this case, and hopefully we'll get a prompt resolution. When will we know? How far away are you from having this settled?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we'll be in a briefing schedule throughout the spring, arguing the case back and forth in the papers. And then I'd anticipate the court will schedule it for argument sometime in April. And we'll hope for a decision a few months after that.
Well, good luck to you. Okay. Our prayers are with you. I hope you do well and you prevail. If people want more information, I'm assuming the best way to get connected is simply pacificlegal.org.
That's a good one, although I'll say on this particular issue, probably the best place to go is homeequitytheft.org, which is a website that we run with a comprehensive overview of the tax foreclosure laws in all 50 states and an analysis of home equity theft laws in the bad states like Minnesota.
That's okay. That's a new site for me. I'll have to check that out. Homeequitytheft.org.
Yeah, homeequitytheft.org. You got it.
That sounds great. Hey, thank you very much, David. Great to talk with you. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
That's, as I said, David Dearson from Pacific Legal. Check out that website, though. I've yet to see it, homeequitytheft.org. But it's something that I thought about for a long time. I think, gosh, you work so hard. I know so many people who've scrimped and saved to own a property and then to think that it could be lost because you failed to make taxes because something happened to you personally. Yeah, sell the house. You know, take, okay, don't give me, if I owe $50,000 worth of tax on a $500,000, don't give me $450,000 back then. Okay, maybe there's fines, there's whatever other costs you have, but $400,000, right? Don't take all the money like they did in the case of this woman, or take all the equity that the person has. I think it's unjust, as we said. So we'll see what happens. Anyway, we got a lot to get into here. When we come back, I want to change gears. You know, this whole concept of defunding the police has been pretty big, right? A lot of people love that. Well, I am now seeing some real bad analysis. There's been a drop, a precipitous drop, in the number of police officers and even some government employees. And it raises the question, who will be the first responders in the future? Who, you know, what's going to happen as police employment declines? And why is defunding these police such a bad idea? We'll look at that and a whole lot more. Stay with me.
All the issues, all the topics, one place. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More info, including disclosures at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
Gunshot victims, 122 West Garvey Avenue, stage at Newmark and Ramona.
This is going to be an MCI. Let's set up for an MCI at this time. We have 16 patients at this time. Let's go ahead. Our engine 62 assists Quint 61 with triage. Now, you also do the triage group of Quint 61. We have multiple patients at this time.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was a police scanner from this recent L.A. shooting. And I was just sharing with you a little bit about that 72-year-old man who went in and took the lives of many innocent people and then took his own. It's a tragedy all the way around. It also made me think about where we are today. There is a move to defund police. And we've talked about this in the past. I want to zoom out a little bit. We'll take a little bit of a broader view. But I've seen reports. I've seen data now showing how numbers for recruitment are way down. I don't know about you. You know, if somebody threatens you, hurts you. In fact, here, a quick story before I get into all this. I had heard a commentary from a Fox reporter today. I was sharing this with Maggie a little bit earlier. He watched the Giants game, was at a bar, and hops on a subway. And he's on his way home, and he sees a bunch of teenage kids, they're 15, 16 years old, they're lighting up a joint. And then one kid, as he lit up the joint, took it and put it in the hair of an older man sitting there on the subway. His hair goes up in flames. The guy's patting it, trying to get it out. So meanwhile, this guy says to him, yo, you don't do that. You can't be doing that. And what did the crowd of teenagers do? They turned on him and they began to pummel, beat, pound on him. And one guy saying, make him, put him to sleep. Put him to sleep. Meaning knocking him out, right? Knock him out. Put him to sleep. And see, meanwhile, he was covering his head so he wouldn't get, you know, he would get head injury. But meanwhile, his ribs, his side, his knees, black and blue, he's beaten. He got off the subway, got on another, and they followed him there. And they said, see, if you would have kept your mouth shut, this wouldn't have happened to you. But the sad part was nobody else helped him, right? He's like, where's everybody else? There were like 30 people on that train, right? Where was everyone else? So weird. But it may be, and his comment was this. It makes me think about this with police numbers. He says, why do I, the weather guy, have to, you know, try to fight crime on the subway? That's the job of the police. But look, this is more common when you are in trouble, when you have that car accident, when you have that heart attack, when there's that domestic abuse, when you're robbed, when there's tragedy, who comes? It's the first responders or it's law enforcement. You know, we're not seeing that. You know, ever since the George Floyd riots in 2020, there's been all these shouts to defund the police, right? Defund them. And we've known that the numbers of people in police forces have gone down. The pressures that they face, too, and one of the tragedies are a lot of these police officers end their own life by their own hand, with their own weapon. You know, it's a tough job. My heart goes out to every one of you men and women who serve. I'm grateful for you. You know, the pressures you face, not being backed up by your command or by lawmakers or administrators, make your working environment very stressful. And I know that's why a lot of these people are leaving. You know, they're positioned in droves, or leaving law enforcement in droves. And that's not good for us. It doesn't make America safer. If there's a bad cop, get rid of them. There should be no abuse. There should be justice. There should be equality. We're all in the same thing. There shouldn't be discrimination. Get rid of those guys. You just can't broad brush every law enforcement officer. I think it's tragic. What's been hard is that no one's wanting to step in and take on those roles. The Marshall Project, it does journalism about police work. They did some in-depth look at the numbers. And what they found wasn't very comforting if you want police protection in your city. And this is why I want to talk about it. I came across this report over the weekend. All across the state of the nation right now, all across the country, the numbers of local law enforcement officers dropped by 4% from March of 2020 to August of last year. And then you say, well, that's not much. Drew, really? No, that's just the average across the country. So when you consider individual cities with more than 1 million people, take a look at New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, right? The number of sworn officers dropped twice as fast as the national average. So as this Marshall Project pointed out, even moderately sized cities like Tulsa, Oklahoma, where about, I think they're 400,000, they're losing officers. They should have 960 officers. They only have 800, nearly 17% loss. And you know what makes it worse is that they have violent crime rate now that's twice the national average. So it's not just police; all government jobs are losing, even while the private sector is getting more people back to work. So a lot of animus against the police right now. A lot of animus. I'm joined today by Joe Sikora, a former actor and stuntman, a colleague of mine here at Relevant Radio, gifted author. He's coming out with a brand new book soon. Jot this one down. Tell you how you can get it. You can get it at Amazon. And the title of it is The Whole World is Going Crazy, But You Don't Have To. Actually sounds appropriate for today's conversation, doesn't it? As I said, Joe worked in law enforcement as well. So, and he's also a therapist. So I thought, good guy to have here today. Joe, welcome back.
Oh, man, it's so great to be with you. I love joining you on your show. I love your ministry and what you're doing. And this is such a great topic. Coincidentally, it's funny, on Friday night, Drew, I had two of my best friends in the world come over to my house to have a barbecue and hang out. Just total guys' night. And they were both former cops. And we spent hours talking about the state, the current state of police work, and then what it was like when we were working. I was a reserve for 10 years, and then I became full-time for 7 years after that. So I have an interesting perspective. You know, I just did it because I had this great love to serve. Yes, I did like the action. I felt like this was a way for me to use the gifts that God had given me to serve my community. But the truth is, it has changed so radically now. I was asking them, it's like, okay, who do you know who's still working? What's it like out there? And it's pretty crazy, because not only are you losing police officers, people say, wait, why would I do this incredibly difficult job for not a lot of money?
Right.
But especially when you don't have the community involvement, the community backing, nobody wants to do it. It's an incredibly difficult job. And even if you could get all the numbers that you said, like you said, in Tulsa or wherever, right, Santa Monica, say, okay, we have enough cops. Unless those police officers, the men and women, are actually willing to go out and to be proactive to try to prevent crime, you know, you're going to see crime continue to rise. And it's tragic. I think there's going to be a swing, but there's a lot of naivete when it comes to understanding what police do and everything else. It was really funny. When I was a cop, you're going to think I'm crazy here. When I was a cop, sometimes I'd come back after a long shift and I'd sit down. I said, I got to relax for a while. What will I do? Yeah. And I'd grab a beer or something. I'd sit down and I would watch Cops.
That's hilarious.
It sounds ridiculous. But it's like, I love to see how people did this. But now there's just this lack of knowledge. And let me just say one thing, too. I don't blame people. It's really hard to understand what it is that police officers do. It's really, really hard. But I was listening like a week or so ago to our president. And this is not political. This is not left or right. But somebody who you'd really think would have some understanding of what this is. And he said something like, you know, well, we've got to treat them to wound, not to kill. And I thought, Mr. President, you have men with guns and women with guns protecting you. Ask them that question. Is that realistic? Can you actually do that? Can you shoot the gun out of somebody's hand? Yeah, right. Can you shoot them in the leg? There's just an incredibly lack of knowledge about the difficulties of the job.
You're supposed to shoot center mass, right? I mean, you can't try to shoot a weapon out of somebody's hand. It's too dangerous. You know, that's silly. Well, where are we today, Joe? I mean, in terms of attitudes when it comes to police, to people recognize them for the noble role that they serve, or has the media, you know, we've had these George Floyd riots. We had a lot of other cases of abuse throughout the country, which are all horrific. And unfortunately, people, it's like the priesthood almost, you know, 96% of the priesthood, probably even higher, noble, honorable men. But in that priestly scandal, 4% of the priesthood was swept up in it. These 96 other percent suffered due to the sins of that four. I think the same thing in the police force. You get a few guys that might abuse their authority, and as a result, everybody else has to suffer for it at large. But I don't know where the American public sees through that. How do you read it? Where are attitudes right now towards defunding police and sending out social workers or approaching law enforcement differently?
Well, first of all, the sending out social workers, again, is incredibly naive, because you just don't understand what you're facing. I worked in the city of Santa Monica, and I loved the men and women I worked with and worked for. From the chief on down, I truly thought I worked for the best of the best. I was real honored to get to do the work. But I remember many calls. I actually wrote about one of these calls in the book, Defying Gravity. Mm. I don't know if you remember.
I do.
But these are people who are literally, yes, a real threat to themselves, but a threat to other people, too. You don't think about it, but when somebody says, hey, I'm going to jump off the bridge, you know, it's like that's a crisis response. You've got to get them to stop, not only to take their own lives, but to hurt somebody else. Or they're threatening crowds with guns or knives or whatever else. You know, what police do in a case like that, which I did frequently as a police officer, is you settle them down, You take them into custody and you bring them immediately to a psychiatric hospital. Right. And they do what they do with them. You know, sometimes they give them just that crisis treatment and let them go. It's kind of a Band-Aid a lot of times what happens. But again, it's just not realistic. And I'm a therapist.
Yeah.
But you can't call me up in the middle of the night and say, hey, can you come talk to this person? They're about to jump off the bridge or something like that. So it's really, it's a naive idea. And I would never actually expect somebody to get it completely, how difficult the job it is, how dark it is. But I'll tell you this one story. I'll remember, Drew. We had a lot of, our chief was very like, you know, we got to have the community involvement and all that. He was way ahead of his time, I think. And we had this computer programming thing where it set up down in the range where you could have simulations, shoot, don't shoot scenarios.
Right.
And you're not shooting real guns, but it kind of shows you where you shoot and stuff like that. And we would show them how to go in. And it's like, okay, you got to make this last minute decision. And the police would do it, and hardly anybody got shot. And then the community would come in and say, yeah, I want to understand. They shot everybody. It's like, well, they look really bad. It's like, so, you know, it's like, again, I think the more that people can really try to understand, you know, what it is that they do, but minimally, you know, give that support. If you see a police officer, I still do it today. If I'm driving around in L.A. or something like that, and I pull up next to a police, I'll say, officers, thank you so much for your service, because there's a lack of support. And I think it's going to swing, Drew. Yeah, I really do. I think there's a movement back where people are saying, okay, crime is out of control. What do we have to do? So I think it's going to go back in that direction.
Let me do this. Let me open the phones, too. If you want to get in, I only have my guest today for a few moments, but if you want to join us, 888-914-9149. Love to hear from you. It's 888-914-9149. You can join the conversation. You know, I'm not in law enforcement. I'm an observer, right? And the one thing that I'm always shocked by, and I think this goes back to the family, it goes back to parenthood and raising your kids as well. That case I mentioned, you know, about the subway attacking this meteorologist. What were 15-year-old kids doing on a subway at 1 in the morning, right, on a Sunday night? Where are the parents in a situation like that? And I think about what we see today. So many of these people who end up getting injured or the altercation becomes a little bit more violent, they don't comply. You know, keep your hands on the wheel. Yes, sir. No, sir. Do what the officer tells you. They don't get out of the car. If they do get out of the car, they push, they shove, they run, they react. You know, don't reach in that car. Don't reach in that car. You know, and next thing you know, the person's being tased or shot because the officer doesn't know whether he has a gun or a knife in there and how the thing's going to escalate. That is something I think that really needs to be addressed. I think it's part of the problem right now with the culture when it comes to policing. I don't think there's an abuse problem. I think there's really a lack of respect for authority. And I think that's really exacerbating a lot of what we're seeing.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. You know, it's funny. You said something about, you know, the weatherman being attacked and stuff like that. What do you see these days? You see 30 people around, say, let's say some older woman or man is being attacked or something like that. What does everybody do? They don't go to step in. They grab their phones. Oh, I got to record this for posterity or whatever reason. It's like, no, wait a second. You know, we all have to have some responsibility for taking care of each other. You know, what is God's law? There is no greater love than to lay down your life for another person. As Christians, as Catholics, you know, we've got to look out for each other and do what we can. But you're right. I mean, I was thinking, you know, again, there's a part of me, and this is the crazier part of me, that thinks I would love to go back, even at my age right now, later 50s, as a reserve, because I really think we need people who are really committed to safety with good morals and ethics and values to serve. And it's an extraordinarily thankless job. It's an extraordinarily difficult job. But we have to do it. You know, you have to do it. I can't tell you how many times as a police officer, I'm thinking about it right now. It's like where I'd go to a call and it's like a man with a gun and he's threatening this person and everything else. And then I see him and then he takes off and runs. Now that was normally the exception, not the rule, but I'm chasing after this guy through yards thinking, wait a second, this is a man with a gun. He might turn around at any second and shoot at me. Are you ready for that, Joe? And I was, I was well-trained and everything else, but it's still, that's what you face. You know, it's a difficult job. And I just pray there are people who are willing to step back in to do that, to be proactive, to be members of the community, to do what is right and good and serve. But I think first and foremost, and then I'll shut up. I'm sorry, Drew.
No, it's
but okay. you're asking me about about topics that I'm really passionate about. Yep. You are right. As parents, we have this extraordinarily important role to instill in our children values and faith and service and sacrifice. It all starts with the family. If you look at the FBI statistics about what kids end up on drugs or alcohol or go to prison, they're fatherless homes. You know, they're single parent homes. There are kids who have been abused or abandoned. And that's what it comes back to, is really instilling the sense of the importance of family.
Yeah. As well. So my guest today, Joe Sikora, he is the author of a number of books. His latest is The Whole World's Going Crazy, But You Don't Have To. You can get a hold of that. And we're talking today about diminishing numbers. A lot of people failing to sign up to be first responders or to get into law enforcement. Looking at what that means for the future. If you want to join us, if you're on the force, if you're out there, feel free to dial in. The number's 888-914-9149. Our conversation continues right after this short break, and then we'll pray the chaplain. I'll be right back. Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, this September, I'm heading the Relevant Radio's Eucharistic Revival Pilgrimage to Italy with Nativity Pilgrimage. This is available to you. Information available at relevantradio.com/Italy.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy begins soon on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. Yeah, I was just... heard the ad run for that pilgrimage to Italy. I'll tell you more about it. I keep saying that, and I've yet to do that, but there's always so much in the show. Hey, I just want to say, I hope you can come. It is going to be a spectacular trip. We're going to be on the hunt for many different Eucharistic miracles. We'll be praying at some very, very grace-filled places and seeing some great historical sites like the Sistine Chapel and the Colosseum and all that you'll see as you visit the Eternal City. A lot of people are saying, hey, I want to go. A lot of people have reached out to me already. Do yourself a favor, get information and reserve your place, because once they shut the trip off, you'll have to either go on a waiting list or not be able to make this one. So it's relevantradio.com/Italy. Relevantradio.com/Italy. Nativity Pilgrimage is the one that is spearheading it for Relevant, and their phone number's there and a brochure's there. So if you have questions, you go to the site and say, I want to know more. Just give Nativity a call. Their number's there, and say, I'm interested in this Drew Mariani pilgrimage. This Eucharistic revival pilgrimage is what we're calling it, because it's really going to be all about the Eucharist. All right, and we'll have Mass every day and a lot more. If you're just tuning in, I saw a report, and it talked about the future of first responders and police, and those numbers are right now in decline. People don't want to get into law enforcement. A lot of officers are getting out earlier. I saw a story early today about some protesters using an area they called the Atlanta Forest for a new academy. The police were going to use this, I guess, for police training. And then the Hollywood Soundstage wants to move in there as well. And they called for a night of rage in Atlanta, protesters, right? A number of the protesters did just that. They set police cars on fire. They threw rocks, causing just general mayhem. Fortunately, the riot got quelled pretty quickly. But it's still a sign that things can very easily get out of hand. You know, they can go awry very, very quickly. And we need good, well-trained law enforcement. Joe Sikora served for years. He also broadcast here on this network for a while as a family therapist. And he's the author of a book called Defying Gravity. And as I said, the other one that's coming out right now is The Whole World's Going Crazy, But You Don't Have To. That's available on Amazon. Joe, let me ask you, I want to jump right back into the phone screen very quickly. What does this portend for the future? You know, as I see less people signing up for what are really important services, you know, law enforcement, first responders, what does diminishing recruitment mean for the future?
Well, I think you see it in real time. The rise of crime, you know, and communities that are increasingly unsafe. I really think it's not going to be until people say, all right, enough. You know, we want our children to be safe. We want our families to be safe. We want to be able to have a business and do commerce and be safe. I think until there's just this overwhelming cry for that, you're going to continue to see this slip and more people. Very interesting. My sister just texted me on the break, and she was a police officer in Minnesota. And I just recalled this. I think I was a reserve police officer. And she said, Joe, I'm thinking about, and she was talking to my brother, Dave, who is also a police officer. She goes, you know, I think I'd be a cop. And I was like, no, don't do it. Don't do it. And yet she was a fantastic police officer, had got all sorts of awards and everything else, really served in such a wonderful capacity. But I think, again, and it's not just numbers, Drew. It, you know, you need police officers who are really willing to go out there and engage. That's what I like to do. I like to prevent crime. You know, you could be a glorified secretary with a gun and go sometime after a crime had been committed and say, oh, tell me what happened. And of course, you know, I'm exaggerating a little bit. You'd follow up the detectives and you try to make an arrest. But the truth is, we want to prevent crime. You know, we don't want people to get hurt and have to make a report. But to do that, you have to be really proactive, you know, to talk to people, to stop people. It doesn't mean you have to write everybody a ticket or take everybody to jail. Yeah. But you've got to really be willing to be engaged. And that's what I found. That was my love. You know, I love to go out and find people who I thought, okay, this looks suspicious. Let me see if I can develop probable cause to make a legal stop, to talk to this person. Right. And lo and behold, you know, when those parolees who are, you know, at large or whatever else, when they go back to jail, God bless them. Yep. I know they had a tough past too. But this is about defending the innocent, the people who still have a chance to make something of their lives. Right.
Well, let's do this. Let's grab a few calls, Joe, because I only got a couple minutes left. You know how this works. Samuel's in San Antonio, Texas. He's got a comment for you. Hi, Samuel.
Hey, Joe, thanks for being a policeman. I'm a retired Marine, and when I see you guys on the streets, I'm so happy because I know that you're in a different warfare, and you're in the front line right now of the major warfare in the world. And I want to thank police officers. You're the greatest people I've ever seen, plus the firemen as well. But the policemen, I really love you guys. Please be encouraged. I just hope that the community comes behind you. Thanks.
All right. Hey, Samuel, thank you for that. Great words, huh, Joe? I love it.
I love it, too. I remember my nephew, who was a Marine, and he got back from a tour in Afghanistan. And we were talking shop a little bit, like, what was it like for you? What'd you face? He goes, I don't know. He says, I think you've got it tougher. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, we kind of see the enemy. You don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
That car you saw, you don't know who they are. But hey, thank you too for your service. So, you know, I mean, that's what we have to do, is serve in some way, as you do, Drew, right? You're serving, you're sharing the faith, you're being a source and a voice of encouragement to strengthen families, to strengthen people in their faith. And that's really what it's all about, to take whatever gift God has given you and use it for His glory.
Amen to that. Thank you, Joe. JT is in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, JT.
Hey, another old Marine here. Looks like, world is full of us lately.
Semper Fi.
Hey, I would, Semper Fi, I would not get into law enforcement these days. I back the blue as much as you could. Half my wife's family retired NYPD. My brother just retired from corrections in New York. And even I took a test for TSA. Yeah. A few years ago, and they actually made me an offer, went through the process, and after talking with my brother, he said, don't do it. He said, last thing you want to get into these days is anything law enforcement related. And I agreed with him, and I did not proceed with the hiring process. I just think everything you do is under a microscope, right or wrong. People, everyone's out there with their cameras, everybody, and there's not a lot of support for our police officers or anybody in law enforcement. These are weird times, to say the least.
Yeah, certainly are. Well, JT, thank you for your service, brother. Glad to have you call in. And Joe, I'll let you respond.
You know, I hear exactly what he's saying. It's like when people ask me right now, it's like, Joe, should do it. I go, well, let me tell you what you're facing. You know, and it's a real darkness. You know, there's a real, and it's a spiritual component to it, that is, you're really facing a real darkness to go out there and fight the good fight. But I think people have to be willing to do it. Again, there's a part of me, and I know this sounds crazy, I would consider going back as a reserve, because I think we need people to stand up and say, I'm going to be a part of the solution. And with regards to the cameras, here's what I find interesting. Look, when I was a training officer, and I would always tell my trainees, they'd say, Joe, can we do this? Can I do that? And I said, well, if the chief of police were sitting right here with you, would you say that? Would you do that? If you feel good about that, then do it. I don't have a problem with cameras. Let everybody see everything. The problem is in the editing. They edit out all the information that is important to create context. Why did this shooting happen? Yep. You know, you just see the 8 seconds of, you know, somebody getting shot. You know, it looks terrible.
Yeah.
But you're not understanding the whole picture.
Let me leave it at that point, because we only have a few seconds left. I want to make sure people can get your book. The whole world is going crazy, but you don't have to. It's available now at Amazon?
Not yet. A couple weeks.
You'll hopefully
have me back on so we can talk about it.
You let me know. I'll be glad to do that. I'm always grateful. Thanks, Joe. We're about to pray the chaplet. I'll pray for you and your family.